Chapter 10. We spent the early afternoon at the Natural History Museum, bickering happily over the quality and position of the specimens, before presenting ourselves back at the Sudbury, where the Baroness whisked me immediately into the Princess's private rooms. The next few hours were deeply instructive. As the semi-legitimate daughter of the Prince of Wales, I might have had my own claim to a throne. At least in Ireland, where my father's marriage to my mother, according to Catholic rites, might have been recognised. But if this was what it meant to wear the purple, I had no inclination for the life. The Baroness set to work as if she were planning a military operation, and I was her objective. She hurried me into the bedchamber, where a young woman dressed in a simple blue gown with an enormous lawn apron waited at attention.
"This is Yelena, the princess's personal maid," the Baroness told me. "She is Russian. Her Alpenwalde German is passable, but the accent grates upon the ear, and her English is non-existent. You might try a little French if you must speak with her, but I do not encourage it."
I said a polite hello, but the girl merely looked at me with enormous, slightly blank eyes. Her face had the broad, high-boned look of the Slav, and her blonde hair was neatly plaited and coiled at the nape of her neck. I recalled what JJ had said about Captain Duran's interest in the girl, and I was not surprised. She was quietly pretty, with the watchful look of all good servants. The Baroness rattled off a series of instructions at her in the peculiar Alpenwalder dialect, and the girl bobbed a curtsy to show she understood. I glanced about the room, taking in my surroundings. Furnished in the same quiet luxury as the rest of the suite, the bedchamber was a study in tastefulness. Yelena might not have been the most articulate of servants, but she kept the room neat as a pin. No stray articles of clothing, no traces of face powder or trimmed threads were to be seen. The books on the bedside table had been stacked in order of size, squared off at a precise angle. The pillows on the bed were plumped to an exact sameness, and the chairs tucked in the embrasure of the French windows were as rigidly correct as the sentry outside. Even the récamier of dark raspberry velvet had been positioned exactly in the centre of a faux bois screen stretched across one corner of the room. The only unexpected note came from the plump Persian cat sitting majestically upon the dressing table. It regarded me with a long, unblinking stare. "How do you do?" I said politely, for I have always believed that while one may be familiar immediately upon making a dog's acquaintance, a cat will stand for no such informality. The cat gave me a slow blink of its jeweled eyes.
"That is Gimov," the Baroness told me. "He is spoilt beyond redemption."
"Gimov," I repeated. "What an apt name." It was the French word for the marshmallow flower, Althea officinalis, a most useful herb with a broad white bloom that bore a striking resemblance to the creature before me. The Baroness issued another order to Yelena, who immediately collected the animal from the top of the dressing table and placed it on an azure silken cushion. It meowed by way of complaint, but it seemed to be a token protest only, for it instantly fell to grooming its snowy fur and ignoring us entirely. As the cat attended to his ablutions, I was stripped of my own clothing down to the bare skin, my nakedness swiftly covered with a silk chemise of such delicacy it felt like a fall of rose petals whispering over my flesh. I would rather enjoy playing at being a princess if all the garments were going to be so lavish, I decided. But no sooner had the chemise settled on my skin than I was trussed within an inch of my life into a strangulating corset of merciless dimensions. unlike my own lightweight athletic corset, which permitted great ease of movement with only modest support, this monstrosity was clearly fashioned of steel, with stays that might uphold a battleship if necessity demanded. I cannot breathe, I protested through gasps.
Her Serene Highness has a very small waist, the Baroness replied pitilessly. You will not fit into her clothes if yours is not as narrow.
She and Yelena together bore down with ruthless purpose on the laces again, drawing them tighter still until the stays creaked in protest and the Baroness pronounced herself satisfied. Once I was trussed like a pheasant fit for roasting, she sat me down, with difficulty, at a dressing table, where she gave Yelena detailed instructions about my hair. I watched the girl's reflection in the looking glass as she worked, pins held in her lips, hands moving quickly, deftly, as she first tongued my hair into long, smooth ringlets, then plaited the loose curls into a series of coils at the base of my neck and around my ears. Once this was done, a box of false hair was opened, and the Baroness and the maid took a long time selecting the appropriate pieces, the Baroness peering through her monocle as she chose.
"Does the princess wear false hair?" I asked in some astonishment.
The Baroness shrugged.
"Sometimes. Her own hair is much longer than yours, past her knees, in fact, but even she will augment her coiffure if the occasion demands."
"But why?" I asked. "Exactly how much hair does an Alpenwalder woman require?"
"Quite a lot,"
the Baroness told me, as she began to weave in the false pieces herself. Mercifully, they were a match for my own, as the princess and I had nearly identical colouring. The Baroness explained as she worked.
"The Alpenwald played host to a very august visitor some years ago, the Empress Elizabeth of Austria. She was travelling incognita, you understand, but she is very fond of walking, and our lakes offer excellent vistas for such sport. She is a distant cousin of the late hereditary prince, and it was a very great honour to welcome her to the Alpenwald. As a gesture of respect, the court ladies dressed their hair like hers."
"The Austrian Empress has hair like this?" I asked, gesturing towards the lavish construction taking shape upon my head. I had seen photographs of the Empress, of course. She had been one of the great beauties of Europe in her youth, but I had not realized the effect was quite so painstakingly won. The Baroness gave a little laugh.
"To her ankles, the loveliest hair you have ever seen, chestnut brown and shining like silk. Of course, now she is an old woman, like me, and her hair has probably fallen out, but still we keep to the custom at our little court," she added pragmatically.
I darted her a look to see if she was fishing for compliments, but none seemed expected. The Baroness was past her youth, but in spite of the monocle and walking stick, she did not seem worn down by her years. Her eyes were still bright with vitality, and her skin was firm and supple. She deftly wove in another false plait, securing it with a jewel-tipped pin handed her by Yelena.
"Do you always dress the princess's hair?" I asked. "It seems rather mundane work for a noblewoman."
She reconsidered the pin, removing it and thrusting it into place at a more becoming angle.
"It is my honour. For everyday wear, Yelena's talents are sufficient, but when Her Serene Highness is making a public appearance, she prefers the traditional hairstyles of the Alpenwald, for which Yelena has not yet been trained."
Yelena went to the wardrobe and extracted a series of boxes with labels from the most exclusive couturiers in Paris. From the largest, she removed a gown covered in a muslin shroud, laying it as tenderly as she would a babe upon the bed, unwrapping it inch by inch. I stared in awe when it was at last revealed in all its glory. Cut in the most recent fashion, it was narrow of skirt, with an elegantly draped train sweeping to the back in elaborate folds like those of a butterfly's wing. The neckline was low and rounded, and the bodice had been fashioned without sleeves, designed to bear a considerable expanse of flesh. Yelena busied herself laying out the various outer garments and accessories, leaving it to the Baroness to apply the various layers of cosmetics, which she did with a heavy hand, further enhancing my resemblance to the princess.
"Luckily, Her Serene Highness has sick brows," the Baroness told me, lighting a match.
She burned it a moment, then blew it out, waving it for a few seconds to let the glowing end subside to a sooty tip.
"Just a bit of embellishment, and they will be very similar."
She dotted the soot into my brows, blending it carefully and deepening the black hue. She stepped back to regard her handiwork.
"The princess is a little paler than you. She is very mindful of the delicacy of her complexion."
The Baroness's tone carried a light reproof as she pounced my face thickly with rice powder scented with orchid.
"That is better."
She glanced at my hands.
"These have the marks of a woman who works."
I was surprised. My hands were scrupulously clean, but pens leaked, specimen pins scratched. I held them out for her and she coated them with cream, scented with a fragrance that was almost, but not entirely, familiar. "It smells floral, nearly of rose, but something else," I said, trying to place it. "Something like mint."
"It is St. Otilde's wort," she told me. "It is the only thing that grows above the tree line of the Teufelstrepper. It has medicinal properties as well as being fragrant. It will soften your hands, but it will take many applications." "You will not remove your gloves tonight," she told me sternly.
"Your Teufelstrepper must be an interesting place," I mused, "named for the devil and yet hospitable to such a plant." The Baroness smiled.
"Do you know the history of our mountain?"
"Only that it is named for the devil's staircase, a difficult part of the climb." She rolled her eyes heavenwards.
"That is the talk of men. Every Alpenwalder climbs the mountain to prove his manhood, and many of them reach the summit. It is practically a rite of passage for them. They speak of the danger and the difficulty, but it is the women who know the real story of the Teufelstrepper."
Her hands moved deftly, almost automatically, as she went about her tasks. Her voice pitched low and soothing, as if telling a bedtime story.
"Long ago, when the mountain had no name, the prince who ruled our land was a pagan, with a beautiful daughter called Otilde."
"Like your saint," I put in.
"The very same. Now, this prince was eager for riches and honors, so he pledged his beautiful daughter to a great king who was also a pagan. But the princess Otilde had become a Christian, and she refused to marry her father's chosen bridegroom. Her father beat her for her willfulness and threatened other tortures, and so she ran away, climbing up the mountain. Her father and her bridegroom brought search parties up the peak, but no one could find her, for the maiden princess had prayed, and a mist descended from heaven, cloaking her from view. She remained there, safe in her eyrie, where no one could find her. But someone did.
she added, pausing for dramatic effect.
Who? I demanded.
The great tempter himself, Lucifer. He came to the princess and offered her riches to repudiate God and take a pagan husband.
Why should the devil care? I asked.
The Baroness clucked her tongue. Do not ask questions. You look for logic with a scientist's mind, and this is a story about magic.
I fell silent, and she went on. The devil tempted her for 3 days, and each day the princess refused, growing colder and fainter from hunger. But she would not give in, and at last the devil, too cold himself to stay upon the mountain, ran away. Now the princess was too weak to move. The cold and the hunger had stolen her strength, and she lay near death. But she had held fast to her principles. So God called upon the creatures of the forest to help her.
Not I, said the mountain goat.
The Baroness said, in a deep, basso profundo voice.
Nor I, said the fox.
She continued, raising her voice to the sharp edge of a fox's bark.
Nor I, said the squirrel. And so it continued with all the creatures of the forest, except the otter. He climbed from his river, sleek and quick, and he stole a loaf of bread to carry up the mountain to the dying princess. And when she had eaten, he curled himself around her, giving her warmth until her strength was restored. She came down the mountain with the otter at her side and lived long enough to tell her story to the priest who found her. She died in the priest's arms, but her story became legend, and she was made a saint. And that is how the Devil's Staircase, the Teufelstreppe, earned its name.
An unfortunate young woman, I remarked.
Unfortunate. She was called to sainthood,
the Baroness corrected. She was one of the great virgin martyrs, and the only one from the Alpenwald. She carried on with her grooming tasks, and in between she schooled me on matters of etiquette and deportment.
You must carry your head at all times as if you were wearing a crown, she instructed. Of course, tonight you will be.
I have to wear a crown? The assorted false pieces of hair and jeweled hairpins were constricting enough. I was not entirely certain my head would bear more weight.
Not a crown, precisely, she assured me, but a very fine tiara. It is a gala performance, you will recall. The princess must represent her country as a monarch.
She hefted the ring of keys from her belt and went to a portable cabinet in the corner. It was a beautiful affair of inlaid wood, depicting mountain scenes with forests and lakes and dancing bears and lissom maidens. It is a lovely piece, I told her. She lifted out a casket and locked the cabinet carefully up again.
The princess never travels without it. It is an example of our artisan's works.
It might have been another example of Alpenwalder craftsmanship, but it was much more charming than the dreadful goat clock. The casket was also made of wood, but as the Baroness opened it, she showed me the steel panels inside, cushioned with velvet.
A strong box, but made to be pretty. All things that may be made beautiful ought to be, she explained.
She drew out a velvet case and with a flourish flung back the lid. I gasped aloud. The jewels inside were shimmering, catching at the light and tossing it back again,
a thousand times over in an endless parade of brilliance. It was a parure, a matched set of enormous sapphires and amethysts shading from the wine-dark hues of midnight seas to the pale blues and purples of an alpine evening. Larger stones had been set in the frame of the tiara, whilst high loops of jewels circled around smaller gems hung en tremblant to swing gently as the wearer moved. Diamonds twinkled like stars throughout, leading the eye from the tiara to the girandole earrings and on to the high collared necklace. A pair of bracelets and a wide stomacher completed the suite. I stared at them, mesmerized, hardly daring to breathe upon their magnificence. The Baroness's stern expression softened.
They are exquisite, are they not? A collection that once belonged to Marie Louise, the second Empress of Napoleon. One of her nieces married into the Alpenwalder royal family and brought the parure with her. Our princess prefers it to the state jewels because it is lighter.
She signaled to Yelena, who fastened the earrings to my ears the old-fashioned way, by means of narrow silk ribbons tied around the ear to hold the weight of sapphires the size of cherries. They swung heavily against my neck, almost touching the necklace she clasped about my throat. The last piece to go on was the tiara, nestled into the arrangement of plaits. I poked it idly with a finger, watching in concern as it wobbled a little.
How on earth am I to keep it steady? I asked.
The Baroness reached for her chatelaine, extracting a threaded needle. She advanced upon me, and without a word she stitched the tiara into my hair, whipping the needle around the base of the coronet and through one of the false plaits. When she was finished, she gave the tiara a hearty, painful tug.
There, she pronounced in satisfaction. It will sit as it should.
I could scarcely turn my head for the combined weight of the wigs and jewels.
You will soon accustom yourself to it, she assured me. The more you wear it, the less you will notice it.
Luckily, it is only for tonight, I replied. The Baroness said nothing, but turned to Yelena, signalling to her to pack away the various cosmetics, as the Baroness herself locked away the jewel cases. It is only for tonight, I pressed. The Baroness gave me a thin smile.
We have a saying in the Alpenwald, Fräulein. Plans are jokes written by men for God's amusement.
That is hardly reassuring, I told her.
It sounds better in German.
Chapter 11. The Baroness carried on with her preparations by going to the bed, smoothing over the folds of the gown that Yelena had laid out, straightening the various ribbons and laces. She handled the princess's things respectfully, reverently almost. My eyes fell to a large gilded box on the dressing table, the wares of one of our most exclusive chocolatiers, I realized. The Baroness's attention never left the clothing she was inspecting, but nothing escaped her.
You must help yourself, Miss Speedwell, but do so now if you wish a chocolate. It will not be possible once you have begun to dress.
I lifted the lid of the box to find a selection of violet and rose creams, Stoker's favourites. These are rather too rich for me, I said politely, thinking of the delicacies Julien had pressed upon me during luncheon.
Would you care for one, Baroness?
The Baroness's nostrils flared in an expression akin to outraged horror, but she managed a polite refusal.
This is not possible, Fräulein. It is not my place to eat with my princess unless I am invited.
But I am not your princess, I pointed out, and I have invited you. She drew herself up, her posture impeccably straight.
I think it best if I treat you as I would Her Serene Highness, in order to preserve this masquerade.
The Baroness bent again to her task. You are very fond of your princess, I ventured. She carefully plucked a bit of fluff from the skirt of the gown before replying,
I have been in the service of the crown all my life. It is my honor to serve.
How is it that all of you speak such good English?
The princess's great-grandmother was English. One of your own princesses, Sophia Amelia, a sister of your King George III, the poor mad one,
the Baroness said, as she moved a pair of evening slippers exactly perpendicular to the end of the bed. I had known that one of King George's sisters had married the Danish king and had a very bad time of it. Husband run insane, lover beheaded, early death from fever, that sort of thing. But I had not realized any other of his relations had married onto the continent. He was my great-great-grandfather, but I had scarcely given him a thought, other than as the sad old man who had lost the colonies and himself gone mad, ending his life stone deaf and blind to boot, wandering around Windsor Great Park in his nightgown and talking to the oaks. It gave one pause to realize such possibilities were lurking in the family tree.
Was your English princess happy in the Alpenwald? I asked.
The Baroness blinked.
Happy? What do you mean?
Simply that, I said. Was she content to live so far from home? Did she love her husband, her children? The questions seemed to put her at a loss, and she struggled to answer.
I do not know how to reply to this, Fräulein. It is not for princesses to be happy. Their duty is to rule, to set an example.
It sounded ghastly, I decided. Did she have a say in the marriage, or was she simply shipped off?
Shipped off?
The idiom seemed to puzzle her. Yes, carted to the Alpenwald like so much fruit for sale, I said, a trifle tartly. It is a barbaric custom, the exchanging of royal daughters in the manner of livestock trading for the purpose of sealing treaties. Was that her lot?
There was a friendship established between our two nations,
the Baroness admitted.
But this was a good thing. Your kings, named George, brought German values to England. We understand that.
And did the princess bring English values to the Alpenwald? I asked. She primmed her mouth.
It is not, you will forgive me, the place of the English to teach the Alpenwalders anything. We were good to your princess.
She turned away, obviously offended. I hastened to make amends. I did not intend any insult, I assured her. I merely wondered if she did a good job of things, if she ruled well. The Baroness said nothing for a long moment, continuing to straighten and tidy, her chin high in her wounded dignity. I ought to have remembered, with countries, like men, the more diminutive the stature, the more overweening the pride. Finally, she unbent a little.
She was only a consort, she told me. It was not her destiny to rule, but she was popular. She was a pious woman and conducted herself with dignity at all times. There was a grandeur to her that was deeply respected by her people.
Dignity and piety, I thought ruefully. If those were the qualities respected most by the Alpenwalders, it was a devilishly good thing I was only pretending at being their princess. I gave her a winsome smile. And is her granddaughter much like her? The Princess Gisela, I mean. To my surprise, the Baroness did not parry. She threw up her hands in exasperation.
I wish, Shiver, to run away like this, so indiscreet, so irresponsible.
She collapsed onto the recamier, head in her hands. I rose and went to her, putting a hand to her shoulder. You are obviously very fond of your princess. Have you been her lady-in-waiting long?
Since her accession,
she said, with obvious pride as she dropped her hands.
But I was her governess before that. I came to her when she was 14, after I finished my duties as governess to her cousin, Duke Maximilian. I have always served the Alpenwalder royal family, and now...
She broke off, clearly overcome. Do not worry so, Baroness. I am sure it will all be quite all right in the end. She lifted her head, moisture gathering in the corners of her eyes.
You are an optimist, Fräulein. You are very young.
I shrugged. It has been my experience that things generally work out for the best.
For the best.
She gave a hollow laugh.
How can that be? If she does not return...
I tightened my grip on her shoulder in what I hoped was a reassuring gesture.
She will. We can have no doubt.
She smiled in spite of herself.
We, Fräulein? Already you speak like a royal.
I have a very good tutor, Baroness, I told her seriously. Now, come and teach me how to wave. She surged up, horror blanching her cheeks.
One does not wave at the theatre,
she said sternly. With that, she launched into a lengthy explanation of the correct way to acknowledge the public in a theatre.
A slow inclination of the head from the neck, beginning with the most august personages.
When she finished, she led me to the bed, where the gown lay waiting. The fabric shimmered, the heavy silk woven with some starry silver bits that punctuated the extraordinary blue of the background.
It is such a glorious colour.
I breathed at last, putting out a fingertip to touch the folds of the skirt. I trailed down to a silver sequin. A rope of these had been stitched around the base of the skirt, edging the train as well as the neckline.
It is Alpenwalder blue, she told me, the color reserved for our royalty, as it most closely mimics that of the heavens above our country.
Her face shone with pride as she helped me into the gown, drawing it carefully over my undergarments and lacing it tightly into place. As she finished knotting the ribbons, she paused, peering intently at my upper arm.
What is this?
She demanded. She put a fingertip to my flesh, pointing out the small gathering of fresh scars scattered over my arm like a constellation. Battle scars, I am afraid, I told her. I was shot. She reared back in astonishment.
Shot? With a firearm? By whom?
My uncle, I replied truthfully. The Baroness stifled a gasp of horror.
Tell me no more, but this is a noticeable flaw, Fräulein, and it will mark you as different to the princess, to anyone with sharp eyes. We must have a remedy.
She trailed off as she went to the dressing table, rummaging through the drawers until she emerged triumphant. She held a wide ribbon of silver satin, which she tied firmly about my upper arm, securing the ends in a bow. She stepped back to survey the effort, frowning.
What do you think?
Rather dashing, I assured her, and who knows, If anyone does remark upon it, I may find myself in the fashion papers as an innovator. She did not return my smile. She merely gave a grunt and stooped to help me into my shoes, court shoes of velvet in the same shade as the gown, and presented a long velvet mantle furred with a curious silver pelt.
"The Geistenfoch," she explained, "the ghost fox, a small silver fox that lives in the mountains, very rare and very beautiful."
I wondered how many of the poor little beasts had been sacrificed for the robe, but it would be the rankest hypocrisy not to acknowledge that I was glad of the warmth. She draped and pinned a wide riband of white-watered taffeta across my chest, securing it with a remarkably ugly brooch of considerable age. It was set with heavy, old-fashioned stones, depicting a jeweled otter rampant.
"The Order of St. Otild," she informed me. "The otter is her badge, and this order is one of great antiquity. The lesser degrees feature the flower of St. Otild's Wort, but, of course, the princess is a member of the first degree," she said proudly.
Then she pulled on my kid gloves, thin and tight as a second skin, buttoning them past my elbows. She clasped the bracelets of the parure over them, then positioned the mantle atop everything, handing me a matching muff of silver fox before stepping back to view her efforts.
"Will I pass muster?" I asked lightly, but I was conscious, even as I uttered the words, of a rather desperate desire for her approval. It suddenly seemed quite important to me that I do this well, for reasons I dared not even contemplate. She regarded me a long time, sweeping her gaze from the tips of my evening slippers, embroidered with sequins and silver thread, to the tiara atop my crown of false hair. After an agonizing wait, she gave a slow nod.
"You will do."
And I knew that faint praise held a wealth of emotion for her. She swallowed hard as she looked at me, no doubt missing her vanished princess. It was clear the Baroness had great affection for her mistress, no matter how wayward she could be. Before I could offer some comfort, she turned away briskly.
"I must go and make my own toilette," she told me. "You must not crease."
"I should not dream of it," I promised her. "I will sit here until you return."
"Sit!"
The word was nearly a shriek.
"You cannot sit. You must stand. Right there. Do not move. Pretend you are a waxwork from that Madame Tussaud until I return," she instructed.
She left me then, earrings quivering in indignation that I might be foolish enough to do anything as abjectly stupid as sit. I shifted my weight from foot to foot, suddenly acutely conscious of how very awkward it was to simply stand. I listened to the mantle clock, mercifully not an Alpenwalder goat clock, tick over the minutes, and just as the quarter hour chimed, the door from the sitting room eased open. Stoker darted in, closing the door softly behind him. I gasped and instantly regretted it. The corset permitted no deep breaths, and I whooped with laughter as I attempted to catch my breath.
"You needn't be rude about it,"
Stoker reproached me in an injured tone. "Forgive me," I managed. "I did not mean to wound your pride, but moustaches." Stoker had been scrubbed and polished to within an inch of his life, his chin freshly barbered, his nails cleaner than I had ever seen them, every trace of ink and glue removed. His hair had been clubbed back into an old-fashioned queue, and perched atop his head was a shako of dark blue trimmed with silver braid. They had found him a spare uniform, dark blue and silver, each button struck with an image of the Alpenwalder otter of St. Otthild. But it was his face that had undergone the greatest transformation. Between his nose and his lip burgeoned the most extravagant set of moustaches I had ever seen. Like those of the Chancellor and Captain Durand, his had been waxed into the shape of a ram's horns, extending out from the edge of the mouth and then curling back in a grand flourish as black as his hair, thick and dense as a shrubbery. I went to him and poked with an experimental finger. "It looks like a hedgerow. Have you got wildlife in there? I think I spy a badger," I said. He grimaced, or at least I think he did. It was rather difficult to tell with the concealing layer of facial hair. "How on earth did they happen to come by such a monstrosity?" I asked him.
"Apparently they travel with contingencies," he explained. "The moustaches are part of the uniform, and in case any of the officers meet with an accident, there is always a spare to hand."
"But why are you even in uniform?" I demanded. "Surely plain clothes would have been more discreet."
"That is what I thought,"
he told me in an aggrieved tone.
"But then the Chancellor happened to mention that a certain Inspector Mornaday has been tasked with the role of liaison with Special Branch."
"Hell and damnation," I muttered.
"I said a good deal worse when I discovered it," he told me.
Mornaday was a complication we could ill afford. Our sometime ally and occasional champion, Mornaday was unpredictable as quicksilver. He longed for promotion within the confines of Special Branch, something he had recently achieved. But there was no telling how long his goodwill might last. The fact that he harboured a tendresse for J.J. Butterworth complicated the situation. He had, once or twice, to my knowledge, fed her titbits that would give her an exclusive story for the Daily Harbinger. As keen for her advancement as his own, he made certain to paint his involvement in a good light. In payment for his indiscretion, she always mentioned him in laudatory tones. It was a symbiotic relationship, that of parasite and host, I thought bitterly. It was Mornaday's deficiencies of imagination that led him to think he was the host. I knew perfectly well he was often steered towards a story by the impetuous and deeply ambitious Miss Butterworth. "What of Sir Hugo?" I asked suddenly. "If Mornaday is there, his superior cannot be far behind."
"Sir Hugo is abed," he told me, "with gout."
"Poor fellow," I said with real sympathy. "We must send him a nice calf's foot jelly."
"Or perhaps just a calf's foot,"
Stoker suggested, a gleam in his eye. He and Sir Hugo enjoyed a state of armed neutrality at the best of times. I sighed as best as I could in my confining garb. "I suppose we will simply have to make the best of it. Keep your moustaches primped and your shako pulled low." Stoker gave me an appraising glance, from extravagant jewels to exuberant décolletage.
"I do not think I will be the one they are looking at."
He nodded to the impossible slimness of my waist.
"How can you eat in that?"
"I cannot eat," I told him coldly. "I cannot bend. I cannot breathe. In short, I cannot do anything for which the human body is fashioned. I am an automaton for the evening, a doll, dressed and polished for your amusement." I might have carried on in the same vein, but his attention was drawn to the large gilded box on the dressing table. I sighed. "Rose and violet creams. Help yourself." He required no further urging. With a soft moan of pleasure, he reached into the box and took one of each, mingling the heavy floral creams in a single mouthful. His eyes rolled backwards.
Heaven,
he managed through the chocolate and cream. He reached in to take another, but suddenly his gaze sharpened and he plucked out a piece of curd.
What is this?
I shrugged. A mistake, I realized at once, for it sent my earrings swinging painfully against my neck. A note from the sender, I presume. He shook his head.
I doubt it. It was hid beneath the top layer of chocolates, and it is not precisely friendly.
He handed over the bit of card, a little grubby thanks to its proximity to the chocolates, and printed simply. It smelt of sugar, but the message was none too sweet. Prepare for your end. A threat to the princess, I breathed. I inspected the note for clues, but it had been hastily scrawled in an obvious attempt to disguise the handwriting, each letter printed in a harsh block capital on a torn bit of paper. I turned horrified eyes to Stoker. Poison, I said succinctly. He heaved a sigh and went into the washroom. I do not know exactly what precautions he took to rid himself of the chocolates, but there was the distinct sound of retching, and then the running of water. When he returned, his moustaches were a fraction less exuberant than they had been before, but he appeared well enough. I gripped his face and peered into his eyes. Your pupils seem normal. Stick out your tongue, I ordered. He pushed my hands aside, but gently, as he stuck out his tongue. His breath smelt of peppermint drops.
I am perfectly fine, he insisted.
You may have been poisoned, I pointed out.
Hardly likely, he said. The chocolates smelt untasted fine.
Some tasteless substance, I began.
Much more common in fiction than in reality,
he assured me.
And I have rid myself of anything possibly noxious, which was a dreadful waste of good chocolate.
I gave him a narrow look. You will tell me if you feel at all unwell.
Well, I am hungry now,
he told me, stroking his chin thoughtfully. He rummaged in his pockets, unearthing a slab of shortbread wrapped in paper. You have the digestive capabilities of a gannet, I told him. I turned my attention to the box. When was this delivered? He examined it closely, shrugging.
There is nothing to indicate when it arrived or from whom.
Do you think she saw it? He considered a moment.
I should think not. If she saw it, she would have surely shown it to Durand or the Chancellor.
She mightn't have liked to, I pointed out. It is rather unpleasant.
All the more reason to pass it to the men responsible for her security, Stoker countered. And if she chose not to do so, why replace it in the box?
Out of sight, out of mind, I suggested. A stalwart soul might have faced the thing directly, but we have heard from those nearest to her that she has been known to be elusive. Perhaps this is the sort of thing she runs away from. His gaze sharpened.
You think she saw this and left of her own accord rather than being abducted?
I think we cannot rule anything out at present. I thrust the note back into the box, carefully concealing it with the remaining bonbons. There is no time to deal with this at present, but it is evidence of something. I only wish I knew what. Stoker reached for my arm.
Veronica, I do not like this, he began.
Before he could finish, the air was rent with a shriek.
Unhand her, sir. You will mark the velvet.
The Baroness entered, as stately as a ship in full sail. She had dressed her own hair in a more modest approximation of my own coiffure, piled high and embellished with plaits and jeweled pins. A tiara of garnets and enormous pearls sat atop, the tremblant pearls quivering in outrage. Her gown was the same hue as her gemstones, dark velvety red and edged in sables. The colours warming her pale cheeks almost as effectively as her rouge. A sash of the Order of St. Otilde crossed her bodice, pinned neatly with a jewelled otter badge. She wore no other decorations, but it was enough. She looked every inch the regal court lady. She flicked a closed fan at Stoker, rapping him sharply upon the knuckles.
"Know your place, sir."
He gave her a deferential bow and tried to catch my eye, but I let my gaze slide just to the side, never quite meeting his. It would have been an excellent joke to share if I had permitted it, but I felt unlike myself in the princess's clothes, armoured almost, in satin and diamonds, aloof and untouchable. And when the Baroness beckoned for me to walk ahead of her, I stepped forward on feet that scarcely seemed to touch the ground. Just then, the sound of raised voices came from the sitting room. The Chancellor made an exclamation of some strong emotion, although whether it was pleasure or rage, I could not say. The Baroness raised an imperious hand to me and to Stoker.
"Wait here,"
she instructed. She slipped through the door, and after a moment her voice was added to the muffled conversation. I could hear a man's laugh, distinctly not the Chancellor's, and then the voices carried on for a few minutes, low tones occasionally punctuated by a quick question or exclamation from the visitor. At length, the Baroness flung open the door, her colour high.
"Fräulein, you will come," she said.
Stoker followed in my wake, and I could feel the warmth of him standing just behind me when I stopped. The Chancellor had been joined by a gentleman slightly taller than average height. He wore the customary Alpenwalder moustaches, but his were of a rich chestnut hue, only a little darker than the burnished waves of his hair. His eyes were very dark and bright with interest as he regarded me. He was wearing a uniform similar to the Chancellor's, but with a dozen more medals and a riband of the princely order. Everything about him was just a shade more. Where the Chancellor and the Baroness were limned in watercolours, this fellow was cast in brilliant oils. His mouth, pink and plump-lipped, curved into a smile as I approached. He surveyed me up and down, quickly at first, then a second time more slowly, and not as respectfully as he would have done his princess, I was certain. He did not scrutinize, he ravished.
"Enchanting,"
he said, in a low, melodious voice. He swept into a sudden low bow, his half-cape touching the carpet.
"I am your Serene Highness's most humble servant," he said.
I froze. Was I meant to play the part of the princess already? I had not been prepared for this meeting. Before I could respond, he looked up at me through his lashes, grasping my hand.
"Your most humble servant,"
he repeated, brushing his whiskers over my fingers. But his thumb was doing something decidedly uncourtly to my palm, and I withdrew my hand as he laughed, showing a good deal of his straight white teeth. He turned to the Chancellor.
"She is the very image of Gisela. Well done."
"You have the advantage of me, sir," I told him, but I already knew. I had known the moment I laid eyes upon him, although the photographs had not done him half justice. He grinned.
"Permit me to introduce myself, mademoiselle. I am His Grace Maximilian, Duke of Lockendorf and the Alpenwald, and your fiancée.